Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick. Today we're doing our CISSP content. And specifically in this episode, we're going to be getting into physical security as well as personnel security. And here to help us with that is Mr. Adam Gordon. How's it going, Adam?
I'm feeling rather secure this morning and a little personal, so we'll see how that goes. But when we talk about both physical and personnel security, what we're thinking about is how do we safeguard information, how do we safeguard resources, but how do we also safeguard the most important resource, the individuals that work for us when they're traveling, when they're outside the organization. You know, these are kind of things that we also have to think about. So if we start from the assumption that the main goal, the primary goal of security is to provide both confidentiality, as we've often talked about, integrity, and availability. When we're thinking about safeguarding those things, we're thinking about protection mechanisms that effectively are going to allow us to do so in a way that's not obtrusive. We don't want to get in the way of people doing their jobs. We want to do so in a way that allows for people to access information when necessary. But we also want to make a clear statement at the same time that we are attempting to secure something, and people need to pay attention to that. When we think about physical security, we've talked in different episodes before about things like having guards in the lobby, having closed-circuit TV cameras, putting up a sign that says area under surveillance, or you know, do not trespass, having a fence. These are all things that are examples of physical security. So the essential components of security are still there when we add the word physical in front of it. We just want to make sure that we are using mechanisms that focus us and therefore our ability to provide protection, to provide security in these key areas. When we think about a physical system, think about the parts that make it up, you know, it may be hard sometimes to envision how we're ultimately going to offer protection and security to this particular item. So, for instance, if we were to think about the laptop that I'm using, that I'm presenting off of, Mike has one here as well. We have two on the podiums with us. If we think about the security of these two computers in the studio that we're in talking to you and ultimately within the building the studio is in and within the area that the building is built in, we have to think about different levels of security, different rings or concentric circles in theory that form a defensive perimeter for the laptops that are on the podium, in the room, out beyond the room and the rest of the building and out in the building to the various areas outside, right? And we call this defense in depth. We think about the different layers of defense and how we ultimately are interacting through those layers to provide a security barrier, multiple barriers, that will allow us to effectively protect and ultimately provide confidentiality, integrity, and availability protections to the systems at the heart of it, in this case, the laptops and the data that they contain. If we create multiple boundaries, multiple borders, or security perimeters around these devices, we are more likely to keep out bad actors and prevent them from getting to our data than if we simply rely on only one protective mechanism. So, for instance, if all we did was physically constrain the laptops by using some sort of locking mechanism and locking them to the podium here in front of us, Mike and I could safely walk out of the room and probably know that nobody would actually walk off with the laptops. They probably would be hard-pressed to steal them. But what if they came up and plugged in a USB device and copied data off the laptops because we left the USB ports active? What if they came up and they were able to somehow insert something into the system that loaded malware into it, or perhaps remotely controlled and remotely connected to the system without even physically interacting with it? But if we left the firewall in a state that would allow inbound connections to take place and somebody was able to connect to the system, maybe remotely they could connect and not even need to worry about being in the room, let alone in the building or even in the area, right? They could be anywhere. So my point is that all these defensive mechanisms have to kind of line up in order to add multiple layers of protection, but the key there is that they have to be additive. It's not enough just to say, I've done something so I'm protected. We have to do multiple things, in other words, because protection is really going to be an interlocking set of controls that have to ultimately add up to a protective solution for us. So we want to be thinking about that. We've talked a lot about access control in prior episodes. Access control plays a part in this. Have to think about whether or not we're going to allow individuals to gain entry into the system. Will they be able to come into the studio and then get to the laptops? The answer is maybe. Depends on what kind of controls we have. Do we have locks on the doors? Do we have cameras that will allow us to see who's out there and buzz people in? Do we have signs on the doors that say, you know, no entry, authorized people only, or whatever? We may do a variety of things, so we want to think about that. We may use different kinds of cards, smart cards, that allow us to swipe in if we have a badging solution on the door. We may have what's called a mag stripe, or just a magnetic stripe card. That's the kind of card that most of us are probably familiar with. Your credit cards, effectively, and your driver's license, depending on what state your driver's license is issued in, is going to look like this. You take your card out of your pocket, flip it over, there's a magnetic stripe of a, you know, thin magnetic tape on the back that holds some information in it. You swipe it through a reader, and the information is transferred to the reader and is read from the card. And then based on the information you provide, the card may or may not authorize some activity to take place. We may have what's known as a prox card or a proximity card. This is going to be a card that is going to have a chip embedded in it, but it is typically not powered itself. It is read from the reader, so the reader provides power to the chip in the card. When the card gets within a couple of feet of the reader, there may be an antenna in the card that will actually allow us to power up and to send and receive signals, and effectively then allow us to exchange information. It really just depends on the nature of the card. But prox cards, you can tell people are using prox cards where if they have a wallet, they take it out and wave it at the reader on the door sometimes, and then the door opens. That's because they have a prox card inside the wallet. Or they may, you know, if they have the lanyard and kind of the card is sitting in their pocket, right? They often walk by and they kind of do one of these and get up close to the reader, or they just walk by the reader like this. But, you know, they have it inside their pocket somewhere, but the door opens because within about a foot or two, those proximity cards power up when they get close to the reader, and they're then able to exchange information, send it back and forth. We may have smart cards with chips that are embedded in the card that you stick into a reader directly. This will be the chip and pin technology that's inserted into new credit cards these days, right? So if your credit card has an actual chip on the front of it or somewhere in it, then that would be something that you know, would actually see. We probably can show you an example of one of those. So you can see that silver area right there, that's the chip that's actually embedded in the card. And so a smart card would have a chip like that, and you can insert it in. I don't have my Microsoft ID with me, or I'd show you that. That also has a chip embedded in it as well. But the idea is basically the same. That chip embedded in my credit card actually is going to be a smart card-like chip that stores information in there and allows us to actually see what it is and where we can then use it in any reader that's going to be able to effectively interact with that information, right? So it's the same general idea. That's what we're thinking about and we're talking about. We may be using things like closed-circuit TVs. We've talked about monitoring. And, you know, one of the things you often have in remote solutions is we will typically have the ability to be able to have an external camera outside somewhere and a monitor so we could see who's standing at the door and, you know, buzz people in, right, without allowing them to actually get in without our knowledge. I've talked about man traps before as well. Man traps are kind of fun. Only if you're controlling the door release on the other side. Otherwise, not so much. But man traps are where you walk into effectively a box, and the box is a gateway between two areas, an unsecured and a secure area, much like a DMZ, but it's actually like a physical DMZ. If you think about the logic of it, you walk through the doorway from the unsecured side, you go into a box that effectively is a, you know, a portion of a room or whatever it is, a hallway that's just been security perimetered off. There may be a guard inside that checks you in. There may not be. You just may be walking through a pass-through portal. There is some sort of activity that goes on. Either somebody looks at you and scans you, you swipe a card, whatever it may be. But however that's done, the first door that leads back to the unsecured area must close and lock securely before the external door, in other words, must close and lock securely before the internal door that lets you into the internal secure area opens up. That's what a man trap is. So you see these in banks a lot these days. Banks are using them where you will effectively walk through the lobby and, you know, you're walking through. It's usually a clear box. You may not even realize you're walking through it unless you happen to look, but it's made of bulletproof glass. And there's a reason for that, because if they stick somebody inside there, they don't want to get out. It's usually because they have a gun because they're trying to hold up the bank. So you walk through this portal. And the reason for it, ultimately, is that if somebody does try to hold up the bank as they're trying to escape, they basically get stuck in the box. And then the police come along and, you know, capture them, but they can't get out because they can't shoot their way out and they can't break out, typically. We also see these a lot, believe it or not, in hospitals, on maternity floors where the babies are, because, unfortunately, there have been rashes of baby thefts over the years. And as a result of that, they're doing the man traps. They're also doing the baby lowjack, where they actually, and we did this when my kids were born. It's kind of cool. They put a band band on the parent, right? So you get an arm, you know, a little armband that identifies you, and the mother and the father have it, and they band the baby with a little band that matches, but they also have a little transceiver on it. So if the baby gets taken for some reason and they're not, you know, all the other security mechanisms fail, they can track the baby anywhere in the hospital because they have the wireless sensors that read the tag that can tell you where the child is. So it's actually kind of cool because they match your bands. You walk through a man trap. They match your bands up and register you and say, well, do you have a child that's here? And they don't let you in if you don't actually have a registered child. So it's kind of interesting how they do these things. But they're adapting those security technologies to obviously places where they need them. So things like surveillance, deterrence, assessment, these are all things that closed circuit TVs and these kind of technologies can actually provide for us. So want to think about that. What about external monitoring? Things that take place on the outer perimeter, such as infrared sensors, right? So we may have low light sensors where we can set up a sensor net or a mesh or a web of interlocking light beams. If you cross the beam, then the alarm goes off. May have microwave relays that are being used. Again, you know, sending out, signals across a beam that are invisible to the human eye. And so you walk through that beam and effectively break that plane. So they can use microwaves to do this, infrared. We can use all sorts of different things. You may have coaxial strain sensitive cabling. Effectively, what that means is you have a fence that's got some sort of mesh running through it. If you cut through the fence, you effectively set off the alarm because the interwoven mesh is the alarm system. It's the alarm matrix or grid. And when you cut through the fence, you cut the contacts and set off the alarm. We obviously have motion sensitive lighting, lighting that comes on when we move, things like that. We have cameras that track motion, night vision so they can see people moving around in low light scenarios, monitoring displays, so we have heads-up displays that let us see large volumes of areas. We talked about guards, talked about alarms. These are all ways in which we can monitor electronically, but also not just electronically, but internally versus externally is what we're thinking about. And these are typically external monitor solutions, but some of them could be approached and used for internal. Things like infrared light beams can be used internally as well as externally in some situations. May have acoustic sensors, may have card readers, we may have passive infrared technology that's used inside buildings, things like that. So this is where you have like a sensor on the door or a sensor in the room and you walk in, the lights go on, the door opens, that kind of thing. That's passive infrared technology. It just reads the fact you're there and it opens up for you. You may have badge control, automatic request to exit, what are called REX systems, where, again, you may have the sensor that you walk up to. When the system is active, it automatically lets you out. You may have to hit a button that will release a mag lock or something like that to get out. There's different ways these systems may work. But these are all monitoring systems that would allow us to physically secure areas. Things like doors we've talked about, windows we've talked about, turnstiles. We've talked about man traps, locks, keys, safes. These are all examples of physical security solutions that we may choose to implement. When we think about physical security inside of an organization, there's a lot of different approaches, in other words, right? It doesn't have to be complex. It doesn't have to be expensive. It just has to work. And the more complex we make it sometimes, the harder it is to get it to work. The reality is a guard sitting at a desk asking people to sign in when they walk into a lobby is an incredibly effective and relatively cost-efficient mechanism for physical control. Having an automated building, you know, system that has, you know, the touchscreen for typing in the person you want to see and, you know, sending the request to them, and it automatically unlocks the elevator and tells you where to go and, you know, all that stuff. That's all cool. The reality is, just one good EMP device, and it's all gone, right? I mean, it's all a smoking ruin. So the reality is, it may be overly complex. It works really well. I have a customer, for instance, one of my big customers in the Caribbean, that has the only LEED building certified that I know of in their country right now. Really cool technology. They got all whiz-bang stuff, all sorts of bells and whistles. And it's really, I love going to visit them when I'm there because you walk in, building's fully automated. So you walk up to the desk. They do have guards and stuff there, but you walk up, you tell them who you're there to see. They say, okay, no problem. They notify them. And then when the person comes down, they'll tell you, okay, elevator 5. Why 5? Because elevators are programmed automatically managed in the building based on power and load. There's a computer that does all this. So based on who you're going to see, what floor they're on, and where everybody else is in the elevator chain as they're going up and down, they tell you what elevator to use because that's the optimized elevator for you based on power management. Kind of an interesting concept, really. It's kind of cool. They lock out floors you're not allowed to get to as a guest, so they don't let you get off anywhere else. Mm-hmm. So they totally control the system, which is neat. But, you know, it's a lot of technology. What if something goes wrong? What if you're in the elevator and the computer decides to go take a coffee break? I don't know. I mean, that could happen. It is Windows. It could theoretically decide it wants to have a break. Who knows what? I'm just pointing out, reality is, you know, when that kind of stuff is working, it works really well. But when that kind of stuff doesn't work, you know, maybe it's not working so well. So my question as a security professional is always, what's my fallback, right? Mm-hmm. If I can't auto-assign elevators and lock out floors, are the elevators going to open on every floor as they pick people up if the system isn't working? Can somebody who's supposed to go to floor 5 get off on floor 2 and go see something they're not supposed to see? If the answer is yes, I better have a guard that's riding up and down that elevator asking you where you're going and making sure you don't get off on a floor you're not authorized to see. And I better be writing down on a piece of paper what floor you're going to and make you give that to the guard before you get on the elevator. That's a manual process. It's time intensive. But guess what? Pencils and papers don't tend to break very often. Pencils do. I shouldn't say that, right? But pens and pencils and papers are going to be really good analog technology. You know, sometimes the old-fashioned works really well is what I'm suggesting to you. And what we often overlook as security professionals in the modern world with all the whiz-bang technology that we use is that there may be a simpler and easier way to get to the same place. It may not be as sexy, may not be as cool, may not be as exciting, but it's going to work really well. And sometimes really well is what's most important. Not sexy, cool, and exciting, and wow, look at us, we have the latest technology, and you know, aren't we the best? Yeah, you're the best until your technology doesn't work. And then you may not be, because maybe somebody's going to come and take all your stuff away from you. So you always want to be thinking, what can I do if something doesn't work? As a CISSP, incredibly valuable set of skills you want to have in your mind and understand how to deploy. We talked a little bit about personnel security being a focus of this episode as well. So I want to talk about some things that relate to personnel security. Yeah, we've talked before about some of the obvious things. Take your badge off when you go outside the office, right? Don't wear logo wear outside the office. You can wear your cool socks. That is acceptable, but don't wear your logo wear. But, you know, when you travel, think about this. Should you take your laptop with you? Your mobile device with you when you travel. A lot of people say, well, yeah, I'm going on a business trip. That's the whole point, right? But what if you're going to a country where that information may be suspect and that device may be compromised? So, for instance, when people travel overseas to certain countries, they are told in no uncertain terms, depending on which organization they may work for, that they cannot take anything with them that will expose any information. And whatever they take with them is going to effectively be assumed to be compromised when they come back. We call them burn devices. And effectively, you're given a loaner laptop that's got nothing on it, and it's basically a clean load. And when you come back, we sanitize that device. We don't let you hook it up to the network. We take the hard drive, and effectively, we wipe it, and we do a complete scan on the box. Because we assume in certain parts of the world that your devices are going to be the target of espionage. Government and or non-government entities are going to try to hack into your system and take stuff from you. Do you leave your laptop in the hotel when you go to a business meeting, when you travel? Something pretty obvious, right? But a lot of us may do that. If you do that, how do you know what's going on with that machine when you're not there, right? You don't know. Somebody could come in, could implant malware on it, could take the hard drive out, copy it, put it back. You don't know. You have no way of knowing. Oh, I hide it in my luggage is what people tell me. Yeah, I hide it in my luggage because, you know, the thief that breaks in is not smart enough to go open your luggage and go, huh, let me see if Adam left his laptop here. I came all this way. He didn't leave it on the desk. I'm going to leave. I can't believe he did that. How rude. He knew I was coming and he knew I was here to steal it and he put it away. How desensitive or how sensitive, you know, am I supposed to be? So the reality is, you know, people are going to go to that much trouble. They're going to go look in your bag. I just, you know, I hear that from people. I'm like, okay. I mean, if that's the world you live in,
makes you feel good.
Be you, but I don't want to be you in the same place you're being you at the same time you are, right? So, you know, make sure you don't take things that are obviously going to be a problem. You should go through your bags. Take everything out that's going to present a challenge for you. Make sure you don't take that stuff with you. When I travel, I don't take all the credit cards, all the business cards, all the junk that I carry around with me when I'm at home. I take just a couple of things. I take basically a computer, the same computer I work on, if I'm going places that I know I can trust. If I'm going places that I know I'm going to have a problem, I borrow a loaner computer that is essentially a clean machine. And I don't access any secure devices when I'm there. I don't access any secure websites when I'm there. You also got to think about what information you're pulling down through the cloud in these same scenarios. Because if it's going to be taken from you on the machine, I promise you, you connecting to it in the cloud, they're going to look at that traffic as well. People say, oh, but it's encrypted. Oh, but it's secure. It's this, it's that. Yeah, I'm sure it all is. But, you know, if we're talking about a government that's trying to get information from you as opposed to a private entity, and in some of these countries you have to worry about the government spying on you, not just a private entity spying on you, that government has resources that most people don't. That government may be able to read your encrypted traffic. And if you take the chance of accessing it while you're there, they're going to record it at a minimum. Whether they can read it or not is really irrelevant. They're going to have a copy of it. What they do with it at that point is really going to be up to them, and you don't know. Don't do anything, in other words, right, that you don't want people to see is one of the most important things we could tell people about. Train them on when they are traveling. We also have to train them that if they get into duress, if something goes wrong, they have to have a way to contact us and let us know there's a problem. We have to make sure they understand what the procedures and the policies are for traveling, in other words, and that if there is a concern, we have a list of numbers they go down. If they're in a foreign country, they know how to contact an embassy. Somebody's aware of where they are, what their agenda and their travel arrangements are. If they don't show up somewhere, we have to work backwards and figure out why. You know, these are important things we don't often stop and think about, but you have to really consider them, and you have to train your people that are going into the field about these things. You know, they just may walk out the door and go, all right, I got a trip. I'll be back in 2 weeks. See you later. Somebody's got to know where they're going. Somebody's got to know what they're doing. What's their agenda, right? And what's their, you know, kind of their schedule. Making sure we can keep tabs on our people, in other words, is one of the ways we provide for security for them. We may not send them out in the field with a bodyguard, but we have to make sure we know where they are at all times. You know, when I did do some work for Microsoft when I was in the field and I was traveling, and I was in India, for instance, I was traveling with some very high-level executives from Microsoft, senior VPs from the company. And they had handlers and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, people were always around them, keeping them on task and doing whatever. But there were multiple people in that organization that knew our agenda, our itinerary, knew everything we were doing down in the minute, where we were for the entire time we were on that trip. Not because I was so important, they probably could have cared less about me, but because they wanted to know where their people were at all times. And if something went wrong, if we had to contact somebody, somebody had to contact us, whatever, they knew exactly where we were and what we were doing, what meeting we were at, who we were meeting with, who they could contact to get a hold of us at any given moment in our day. Throughout the multi-day trip where I was in, you know, five different places inside India over several weeks, you know, that kind of thing. So it's very important to have that level of detail, to have that level of understanding of what people are doing and where they are. Agree ahead of time, in other words, on what that will be. Make sure that people are trained on contact procedures. Make sure they understand how to securely safeguard information. Make sure that they understand, you know, something as simple as, you know, not calling 911 right overseas. I mean, the reality is we have a 911 thought process, an emergency services thought process in almost every country in the world, but it's not always 911. And so if you're used to growing up in America, in the United States, and you call 911 for emergency services, what do you do when you're in Mexico? What do you do if you're in Bolivia or Brazil, or you're in, I don't know, Botswana, or you're in Canada? I mean, it may be the same, but it may be a different combination of numbers. You have to know. And it's this kind of stuff that you have to think about training people and giving them the awareness of, because you don't want somebody Googling on the phone trying to figure out how to call the equivalent of the emergency services when there's a problem. You want them to just be able to get what they need. So making sure that people are trained on these things is part of personnel security as well. As CISSPs, we want to make sure that we are thinking about how to safeguard. And remember, this comes back to the code of ethics for us, right? We want to make sure we're safeguarding not just information, but also life. Life safety is very, very critical, very important. The most precious resource that a company has is its people, right? I should work for Hallmark. That was beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
Great card. Right?
A great card, right? But it's very important. All kidding aside, it's very important. It is part of the code of ethics. Safeguard life as well as property. Both are very important. Life is more so. Want to be clear about that, but both important. So we have to focus on both and train our people on both the CISSPs.
Very good, Adam. Great information there. We'll look at physical security as well as personnel security. Obviously very important. All right, Adam, remember, if you guys want to sit in one of Adam's classes live, all you got to do is shoot an email to us here, cadam@itpro.tv. That's going to do it for this one. Signing off, I'm Mike Roderick.
I'm Adam Gordon.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care, everybody.